Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock at the start of a new week. We reflect on the events of this week back in, or this day in particular, back in 1795. The Swellendam Republic would accept a British rule on this day. I wonder how you accept British rule. I suppose if there are weapons involved, it's a completely different conversation. On this day in 1921, the Brown Shirts would be established by none other than the German dictator Adolf Hitler. In 1948, on this day, poet T.S. Eliot would win the Nobel Prize for Literature. In 1977, on this day, the United Nations Security Council would place a weapons embargo on South Africa, banning the sales of arms to South Africa. In 1993, on this day, Sir Elton John would be awarded $518,000 against the Sunday Mirror for a false report they'd made about his diet. 1996, on this day, the Spice Girls would release their debut album, Spice. It would go on to sell 23 million copies. 2001, on this day, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone would premiere in London. And on this day, in 2008, the President of the United States, President Barack Obama, President-elect at the time, President Barack Obama, would defeat John McCain on this day in the U.S. presidential election, becoming the first African-American president. And as we say that, going into tomorrow, we could potentially see the first female African-American president step into the White House. You're tuning into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at Altron results. They gave us an update for the 6 months ended August. We speak to the company's CEO around that performance. We also speak to the CFO of the Redefine Group around their full year's numbers for the full year ended August 2024. Then we have a conversation with Martin Kingston of Rothschilds & Co., who also sits on the steering committee for Business for South Africa, around the state of government business partnerships and where we go to from here. It looks like we're ready for phase two of the CEO pledges, and it looks as though we are keeping things moving in that respect. And then, because it's Monday, we've got a personal finance segment on a Monday. We're going to be chatting to John Vessels from My Way around the myths around car insurance, seeing if we can bust some of those myths and seeing if we can make sense of how to better position our car insurance packages going forward.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we start off the show with how the markets have been moving. We take a look at some market movements throughout the day. It's been a rather quiet day in some respects, markets ending the day basically flat in some areas, but we're joined on the line by the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, that's Makwe Masilela, to take a look at these movements and try and make sense of them. Dr. Masilela, good evening, lovely to speak to you again. Markets not really doing much in South Africa, but it looks as though Asian markets were on the move in early trade this morning.
Definitely. Good evening to you. Remember, the Asian guys, they also had to respond to those job numbers which were released on Friday. We fortunately had a bit of a chance to respond to that. But you are right, you know, nothing much happening. But I think we are largely on the edge, you know, before tomorrow's U.S. presidential elections, with recent polls showing that the race is tight. So more or less, guys are trying to play wait and see, not wanting to commit much.
Marco, we've got that election happening tomorrow, as you said, but we've also got FOMC data out, or interest rate decision from the US Fed expected this week. We've also got an interest rate decision from the Bank of England this week. But clearly the markets couldn't be bothered by what central bank governors have to say. They want to know who the 47th president is, as you mentioned.
Definitely, you know, and as we've seen that the recent increases when it comes to the dollar and treasury yields can be partly attributed to the traders' position for terms victory, which was expected to result in more inflationary policies. But we've seen that the latest report, you know, showing that, hey, Kamala Harris might be edging ahead in some swing states. We see the US dollar index pulling or falling the most in more than a month. But you are right, markets are saying, come Thursday, we expect a 25 basis point cut in the US. Also, the very same Thursday, we expect the Bank of England to do a similar move. But remember, Bank of England decision has been complicated by that sharp sell-off in their gilts, and that was following that Labour Party government budget last week, which also dragged the pound lower. But yes, the front and back of the markets this week continues to be the US election. And we can safely say this is one of the most important or crucial weeks, you know, for 2024 in the US.
Marco, you bring up the US picture and the jobs numbers that came out on Friday. Absolutely, probably one of the worst jobs reports we've seen this year, and the market seemingly undeterred. I mean, the US election is clearly in focus, and some of the other factors are not really relevant at this point to some market participants. How do we then review the US's picture? How do we see the US shaping up, understanding that regardless of who the 47th president is, it is a new president. The 46th mm-hmm. president is not coming back, and markets could still be thinking about a recession. I don't know if they are. I don't know how much of it is still around that. How does the U.S. economy and the state of the U.S. economy look at the moment?
Remember, the numbers Friday, as much as they were bad numbers, is all because of the impact of hurricane labor strikes. So people are not reading much into that. And as we always console ourselves, that, you know what, we don't have to read much, you know, when it just comes to one report, look into the average. That the average has been showing that the U.S. labor market is cooling decently. So, and so far, data has been pointing that we don't even have to think about a recession as we used to. Maybe we might get some form of landing. We can decide whether it's going to be a soft landing or what. But at the end of the day, the fears of a recession are kind of behind us, and as well as the guys starting with a jumbo rate cut. At some point, it was a red, as the guys are fearing that, hey, there's something that they know that we don't know. But now we start thinking that, hey, probably they were playing a catch-up as their counterparts started increase cutting rates before them. But yes, the job numbers, I think, the impact of hurricane labor strikes, markets console themselves saying that that's the one that had a negative impact. But generally, they don't expect things to be worse.
Marco, let's move to some company developments. We've seen a very interesting time in the company space. I don't know if you caught the SENS announcement that Anglo American had agreed to sell its minority stake in one of its businesses for around 1.6 billion Australian dollars. They did tell us that they were going to do a better job of unbundling than BHP. And we did get last week that BHP had updated their offer there. Is there anything here that we need to be keeping an eye on? Are we still even having the BHP Anglo conversation?
It's a nice place to be, you know, because either way, they just have to do something. Whether they as management, they do a better job to unlock value that will benefit our shareholders. Or maybe they're forced to do that so that maybe BHP Billiton will come back with another offer. At the end of the day, it's unlocking value for potential shareholders. But as we know, the guys have always been saying they're trying to be more focused, trying to disinvest, you know, in some of the operations. And remember, that project in Australia itself, the guys were neither involved in the operations thereof, let alone, you know, marketing their products at all. So it was just a mere investment, which was minority, as we said.
Marco, when we look at some of the other developments that came out, or other developments, announcements that we're seeing here, there are some other company news. We know we've got the likes of the Ultron developments and the Redefine developments. Anything else that stood out for you on the local front? I mean, SENS was relatively quiet, but there were still quite a number of announcements.
Yeah, I think my attention, it was more of an exemplar in terms. I mean, why? These guys, Jimmy, remember, they own and manage your township and rural malls, the likes of Alex Mall, Mabopane Square, and First Plaza. I mean, all in all, I think they own 26 retail malls. Revenue up nicely, 9.8%. Interim dividends up 9%. Profits as diluted headline earnings per share up 28%. And Jimmy, their kind of malls tend to have a better footfall compared to those in suburbs. So I think they continue, to offer a compelling proposition. And Redefine as well, not doing that bad. I mean, revenue up 7.5%, profits up 57%, but the dividend per share, down almost 2.9%. And the guys are confident, because we know that confidence and interest rates working in tandem. So you see the bond yields have been going down, and that helped the share prices to go up. So what do you do? It bodes well for them to access the equity markets or using script as a settlement currency. And it's also supportive when it comes to further improvements to the property fundamentals. So not shabby.
Very interesting that the property sectors are now doing so well, Marco. There was a time where we couldn't have this conversation because there was a lot of uncertainty in the property space, and now suddenly we can have this chat more comfortably and more freely. Marco, let's take a quick look at the rand, the currency not doing too much, holding its ground against all of the majors, still in key levels across the board, but we know that obviously with the election, there's going to be a lot of volatility that suddenly re-enters the market. How are we seeing this US story play out for the rand?
I think it's more about that report, showing that Kamala Harris might be edging ahead in some of the swing states. And we see the dollar index falling the most in more than a month. And also it was also falling against the likes of the Mexico peso. Because when you look into our commodity prices, it's more of a mixed picture. So I think it's more what is happening with that kind of unwinding of the Trump trade, more or less so far, and maybe it will get it into a full swing, whether left or right, depending on what pans out come tomorrow.
Certainly going to be an interesting time going into tomorrow's election. We know we might get those results later in the week, and as they will continue to go through. Marco, before I let you go, I want to take a quick look at some of the commodities pricing. We have been seeing platinum and palladium teetering with some key levels. We thought we'd get them starting to move now. We thought that the conversation with the Chinese happening now, we saw the Chinese government meeting to flesh out that stimulus package. You thought that would give some positive sentiment or reignition to the market. Nothing much has happened, or is it still too early to start seeing the results of that?
I think it's a combination of both, because remember, market participants were disappointed with the lack of details. Market participants were disappointed that the Chinese authorities not doing much when it comes to stimulate the economy. But maybe hopefully after the meeting that is happening starting today up until Friday, we might get more or additional stimulus. But the markets are saying, hey, you know what, we thought these things will start pulling up, but maybe we don't have to run ahead of ourselves.
Markets don't like to be disappointed, but hopefully we don't see too much disappointment this week. It's going to certainly be a busy week. We'll leave it at that, Marco. Thank you, as always, for the time and for the insights. Marco Masilela, Chief Investment Officer at Marco Fund Managers, on some of the movements throughout the day and potential movements throughout this week.
The Property Pod.
The township and rural shopping centre subset of the property market continues to thrive, with more development on the go as investors pile in. On the Property Pod this week, we speak to Smital Rambai, Portfolio Manager of the Unlisted Community Property Fund, or Comprop as it is better known. Comprop is invested in SA's township and rural retail property market.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And Altron gave us their results for the 6 months ended August 2024. They told us how they started off their 2025 financial year. I'm joined on the line by the Altron CEO, Werner Kapp, to take a look at the performance of the business and what to expect. Good evening, Werner. Thanks so much for taking the time. By all accounts and by all metrics, business is good.
Jimmy, thanks for having me. Really delighted with this performance. I think it's a really strong performance, which shows that consistent strategy execution has driven positive profit momentum for us. I think our focus on quality, high margin annuity revenue, it's delivered double-digit growth. And I think you're starting to see the scaling up, effect of those platform businesses. Really happy that that's enabled us to raise our guidance in terms of our medium-term profit forecast. So, all in all, nothing to complain about.
Now, Vara, the business operates in a couple of areas. You touched on the platforms areas. There's also IT services, distribution, and other areas of the business. How are you finding that mix? It's obviously been quite beneficial for businesses to be in sort of a more diversified spread, given everything we've gone through. But how are you kind of seeing the mix of the business in terms of performance at the moment?
Very good question, Jimmy. Look, obviously for us, star performers in this half were the platform businesses, particularly Netstar and FinTech, you know, both businesses delivering double-digit revenue growth, significant improvement in EBITDA and operating profit. Slightly disappointing performance by our ADB business, but I think one of the strengths of our portfolio is the fact that when one business may not perform, the other one does really better. You know, those IT services businesses, slightly more exposed to, the capex and decision-making cycles of large-scale enterprises. But I really think it's been a star performance by our platform businesses. And, you know, as I said on the earnings call this morning, as much as, I was a little bit disappointed with the profit performance of the Altron Digital business, you know, what's really pleasing for me is that all the leading indicators in that business, you know, our sales pipeline, you know, our customer satisfaction, our cross-selling into our top customers are heading in the right direction. And that gives me, you know, good confidence in that business going forward.
Varna, when we look at that ADB business, are there kind of like external factors that might be worrying you? It might not necessarily be about that segment, actually. It could be about any other areas of business. Are you seeing some external headwinds that might challenge you over the coming 6 months going into the full year?
I don't think anything more than we're already experiencing in the economy, no. I'm a big believer of sticking to your plan and sticking to your focus. And that's why I think we're really lucky that we've got solutions that provide problems and creates opportunities for our customers. Pardon me. Overall economic conditions in South Africa are still constrained, obviously, Jimmy. But I think if we continue to do what we do well, there's no reason for us to be growth constrained.
Sticking to your plan, it's always important to do that. Otherwise, why do you have the plan in the first place? Part of that plan included a couple of discontinued operations. Anything that's been kind of finalized, gone off, and suddenly no longer have to deal with, or where do we stand on those?
There really were historically two discontinued operations when I got into the job, which was the document solutions business. Now we've actually decided to retain that business. We made that decision in July. That business has been held for sale for probably about 3 years, so it's been really tough for that team, but I think the leadership team's done a really good job in turning that business around. And you know, at the time of disposal, we felt it would be detrimental to our shareholders if we dispose of that. On the other hand, we have made the decision to dispose of our Nexus business, and that's currently progressing actively. So, the Altron Digital business, Altron Document Solutions now really comes into our IT services segment, and Nexus will drop off in time.
Varna, 60% increase in interim dividends. Is that a sign of more to come? How does that kind of shape up with what you have in line for the second half of the year in terms of possibly forecast or expectations of market conditions?
Yeah, look, we're really pleased to be able to, have increased that dividend payment. I think it really speaks to the fact that we've got confidence in the strategy of the business and in sustainable earnings. You know, I think we've worked really hard to build a strong balance sheet. So really delighted to be able to reward shareholders. In terms of the short-term prospects, I go back towards our medium-term guidance. We do believe that if we continue to execute well, then we can achieve that targeted guidance that we've upgraded from 1.1 billion to 1.15 billion from our continued operations by the end of FY26.
That targeted guidance, I was coming to that to say that those are really some interesting targets that you set as a business. How do you shape up going into sort of your second half of the year? Is there any key things that you're looking at from a strategic point of view that are affecting that outlook? I caught some of that in the SENS announcement, but also in the earnings call, that there's a very clear focus to say, while everything is going according to plan, let's maximize on that so that we make sure that we hit those targets.
I think absolutely. I'm going to bore you a little bit, but it absolutely is about continuing to execute on that. But also to make sure that, you know, whilst we're in this accelerated growth phase, and we want to really make sure that we capitalize on the investments that we've made. You know, for example, we consolidated our property portfolio by about 50%, and we decided to reinvest those savings really in customer-focused systems, in investing in our salespeople. So I think it's making sure that we continue to capitalize on those investments and, you know, where there are opportunities, to build, to partner or to buy in that sort of platform space to be able to drive the business going forward, we'll certainly do that.
Werner, are there any other areas of the business that might look appealing at the moment? We've seen a lot of businesses go into this kind of weird phase where you start to find things that are attractive to either acquire or to partner on or to grow the business with. Is there anything that's kind of popping up on the radar that you might even be considering? Not necessarily into at the moment, but might just be looking at?
Yeah, I think we've got a very clear capital allocation strategy, Jimmy. And, you know, what we really are starting to be quite interested in is we are seeing opportunities in that platform business of ours where we're really opening up that platform ecosystems of ours into different, you know, sort of vertical industries, you know, be it insurance, be it media. So I think that's a specific opportunity for us. There's definitely opportunity for geographic diversification, specifically in our Netstar business. You know, we have been operating abroad for quite a long time, and that's something that we will specifically look at. Although for us, it's always important to make sure that we continue to strengthen and expand from our core. You know, you don't want to stay away from opportunities in the market, but you don't want to get caught up with, you know, too many shiny toys that distracts you from your core knitting.
Stay the course, stick to the core, and remember the plan. That sounds like a very good philosophy for running the business. Thank you so much, Werner, for the time and for the insights. We wish you the best of luck in the second half of the year. We look forward to catching up at the end of the year and seeing how this all shapes up. Werner Kapp, CEO of Altron, on the first 6 months of their new financial year.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
One of the largest real estate investment trusts in South Africa, listed on the JSE. In fact, I think they are the second largest, to be precise. Redefine gave us an update on how they performed throughout the year. They gave us their full year results for the year ended 31 August 2024. I have the privilege of speaking to the Redefine Chief Financial Officer, Ntobeko Nyawo, to get a sense of the company's performance and how they fared. Good evening, Ntobeko. Thanks so much for taking the time. Interesting set of numbers, very strong growth on the revenue side of things, very strong headline figures. Your thoughts around just the performance of the group and the business?
Yeah, thank you for having me. Definitely, it's a set of results that we're very proud of because we continue to see that positive organic growth from both our South African operations as well as our Polish operations. So just to give you a sense, I mean, I think from an active NOI point of view, which is our net operating income in South Africa, the portfolio grew by 4.7% to 4.6 billion rand. In this environment, where it's really against the backdrop of this environment, we believe this is a very decent set of results, and we're excited about it. And that's why we are seeing the green shoots in terms of the outlook for a listed property sector.
Ntobeko, as we look at the overall performance of the business and we just take a look at some of the other numbers, we are dangerously close to that 100 billion rand mark in terms of assets. But if we take into account some of the other current assets in play, including those that might be held for sale, we have crossed that threshold. It's quite a key milestone for a real estate investment trust to have a portfolio value of that size and to still be seeing growth.
Yeah, it's quite significant. I think our property asset platform, if you look at just how that 100 billion rand is actually from a capital allocation, is spread between South Africa and Poland. So in South Africa, you're actually looking at about 65%, which is the 64.7 billion rand of our properties in South Africa. And that with the retail bias being the, you know, our biggest significant exposure being in retail. And in Poland, about 34.8% of our properties is in Poland. So I think what it speaks to us is that probably our diversification strategy in terms of capital allocation to geographies that, you know, Poland for us does give us, you know, it weathers better from a fundamental point of view if you compare to the SA Inc. challenges that we face here in our South African operation. But put together, it's the ability then of this portfolio, which I think you've just touched on, the ability of this portfolio to really deliver sustainable growth in this tough environment, which we're very pleased of. Even, I mean, with retail in South Africa, you know, being the one that grew the most, followed by industrial as well as office. And I think that really for us also continues to play to our diversification. And we think that this portfolio is well poised, given its allocation as well to Polish retail as well as to the modern logistics that we have there, that it will capture the emerging trends that we are seeing from a re-rating of the listed property sector.
It's very interesting to see that some companies are doing well in Poland while others have struggled. Ntobeko, let's look at some of the other metrics that are quite important to look at from a real estate investment trust perspective. Loan-to-value ratio kind of staying stable there at 42.3%, manageable year on year. But when we look at things like distributable income and the dividend per share, marginally off, but doesn't look too concerning. I mean, 3% off, still within that range of 90% of your dividend payout ratio. That's still more than impressive.
Yeah, look, I think really for us, it's you know, we're very clear. I think if we just the metric you touched on the balance sheet point of view, our focus this year has been around building an efficient funding model that can support growth. That's why we restructured our SA secured debt of 27.7 billion rand. That's part of those bigger strategic thinking. But from a print point of view, with an LTV at 42.3, but I think also what's also very important in this environment is to access to liquidity. And we continue to maintain very healthy liquidity with if you look at our committed but undrawn facilities and cash on hand, that is printed at 4.8 billion rand. So we believe the business has got a very strong balance sheet that can support its growth path. And I think if you look from an earnings point of view, we did guide the market that will produce earnings this year at distributable income per share between 48 and 52 cents. So to print at 50 cents is actually in the middle of that range that we had guided to, which is really is a interplay between the positive operational performance that you see in our portfolio being slightly offset with the interest rates, where we've had a full year cycle of a high interest rate environment coming through in the numbers.
Now, Ntobeko, it wasn't always as rosy as it looks now. It wasn't always a comfortable space, particularly coming out of the pandemic and interest rates being elevated. Property sectors or property portfolio companies actually went through quite a bit of a tough time, especially on the office side and the industrial side with all of the vacancies that we saw. And you mentioned here that obviously you touched on this a little earlier, saying that the business is well poised to do well going forward. Again, we're back to a point in our lives where we can start to see forecasts. You're probably the second company that's reported numbers in 2024 that have included forecasts that I can remember in recent times. Are we comfortably over some of those really difficult moments? Obviously, the forecast will come with conditions that if everything prevails as it is, but it's nice to see forecasts coming back to the fold.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're always clear that the shift or the pivot in the interest rate cycle will have a material impact on our fundamentals. So we're pleased that we've started seeing that. You know, we saw rates globally by central banks starting to come down. You look at the ECB, you look at what the Fed did, and also our Reserve Bank locally here followed. So I think that for us is one of the things that is really giving us a lot of exciting opportunities. As you know, as our business model is highly geared, so over time, that will play out and support our earnings outlook. But we gave the market earlier today that we forecast our distributable income per share to be between 50 cents and 53 cents in FY 2025. That basically means all factors taken into account, we don't think earnings are going to go backwards, because that 50 cents is very close to the print of this current year. But we're also seeing some signs that we might potentially get to growth of between 5 and 6% on the upper end of our guidance range. But to your point, our value proposition quite clear, 80 to 90% of that we will reward the shareholder in terms of the returns that in terms of our payout policy.
I think that's more comforting to shareholders than anything else, to be able to sit back and see a company say, we don't forecast that things are going to go backwards, we are forecasting things to go forwards. And Ntobeko, let's wrap things up with a look at the number that you mentioned, because we can't let it go. 4.8 billion rand in available facilities and cash on hand, and a combination of those things. What are we looking to buy? Are we looking at any specific areas?
Look, it's really a liquidity buffer in terms of how we manage. If you look at our trend, we normally keep around 5 billion rand of flexible liquidity point. But what it gives us is two things, to your point. Firstly, is that if there was to be any issues, I mean, in terms of the upcoming debt maturities, we've got enough firepower to actually go on if there was a glitch in the market. But we don't expect anything to go wrong in the debt capital market. So we're looking at that in terms of normal. You know, we've got quite significant expansion that we're doing in into our European business. Some of this capital will go supporting in terms of those strategic initiatives. But really, overall for us, it's just a very proactive risk management tool that we keep as part of a highly geared structure.
Proactive risk management tool, but it also does come in handy if you want to buy something and it's on the market at the right price. We'll leave it at that, Ndobeko. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Always a pleasure speaking to you. Ndobeko Nyawo, Chief Financial Officer of Redefine, on the company's full year that was the year ended August 2024.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, for something involving both public and private sectors, business and governments are coming together to build South Africa. Just take a listen to how this is happening.
My name is Bumizi Galala. I am the CEO of Kumba Iono, which is part of the Anglo-American Group. I am also a CEO sponsor within the National Logistics Crisis Committee. And I have to say that I've played an active role as part of the B4SA Steer Corp. And I'm absolutely excited about the launch of Phase 2. One thing that's absolutely critical is that all of us as South Africans have got to come together and work towards the success of our country, and especially business. And for me and for the rest of the CEOs that have come together, we are proud of being companies that operate in South Africa. And we strongly believe that through collaboration, we will get to the type of economic growth that we want to see for our country. And that's for the benefit, ultimately, of all South Africans.
It certainly is to the benefit of all South Africans. We kick off phase two of the CEO pledge, or the commitments from a business for South Africa to get South Africa back on the right track. I'm joined on the line by Martin Kingston, who's the chairman of Rothschilds & Co. South Africa, but also the chairman of the Business for South Africa Steering Committee. Good evening, Mr. Kingston. Thanks so much for taking the time. We saw a successful phase one. I think a lot of skepticism might have been around prior to that to say whether or not businesses and private sector and public sector could work together, and we are into this new government structure. We're proving all these skeptics wrong. Where do we stand on phase one? How successful has that been, and what are we looking forward to now?
Well, good evening, Jimmy, to you and to your listeners. Phase one was, I think, a very successful exercise. It took us some time to put in place the system structures oversight on both government and indeed businesses side. Those are in place, as you will know. We meet with the president every 6 to 8 weeks. We have a joint strategic oversight committee chaired by the director general in the presidency, which oversees the work we're doing in the three primary focus areas of energy, transport and logistics, and crime and corruption. And having set them up and having resourced them appropriately, having put in place the resource mobilization fund, which has raised significant amounts of funds, be able to capacitate both the National Energy Crisis Committee and the National Logistics Crisis Committee, we've seen real and discernible progress, perhaps the most marked of which, of course, has been the absence of load shedding for now well over 6 months and an increase in the energy availability factor. But also in transport and logistics, we've seen key legislation being passed. We've seen an agreement between Transnet, the National Logistics Crisis Committee, and indeed the broader structures, as well as the support from business in identifying what the key breakthrough projects are. And in crime and corruption, as we all know now, we've made real and discernible progress again in reducing the number of items on the Financial Action Task Force grey list. So yes, I think we made real progress in the first 12 months of the partnership, and we are committed to doing more so in the second 12 months.
Martin, before we get to the second 12 months and phase two and what all of that looks like, I want to reflect on, perhaps it might be a little bit of a step back, but not so much, the purpose of putting this together. We, for the first time in our history, were confronted with a new set of challenges when we realized we had to establish a new kind of government. Why was it necessary for the public-private partnerships to come into the party or to come to the party at this point?
Well, of course, this was before the seventh administration and the government of national unity. This was during the sixth administration. You'll remember, Jimmy, of course, that the partnership was originally established with the very serious, I would say, for some, existential crisis posed by the pandemic, when Business for South Africa was born, created by the Black Business Council and Business Unity South Africa, within which it is housed, and the recognition that we needed to actually crowd in all of the capable resources and capacity in the country to save both lives and livelihoods. That extended to the rollout of the vaccination program. And we all knew that we went into the pandemic, both having been downgraded to junk status, but also being in a recession, and that we'd need to have a concerted effort to be able to put ourselves on the appropriate trajectory for an inclusive approach to growth. And the only way that we could do that was by harnessing all of the capacity of the private sector in support of government. That, I think, was the genesis of an acknowledgement, and the president has been very clear from the outset, of the fact that we do need to actually, as I said, mobilize all the necessary expertise, experience, and resources and put it at the disposal of the country.
When a decision like that is taken, Martin, obviously when it's taken for the first time, there are going to be challenges, and I want to look at those. I want to get a sense of some of the areas that may have been a bit difficult to get past, whether it's legislative, whether it's just finding or getting everybody on the same page, because it's obviously not possible to start something new without anticipating some form of challenges, but we've overcome those challenges. But what were some of those challenges?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, actually. So I would have to say, Jimmy, that one of it was making sure that we had the right level of support on both sides. In the case of business, we've made sure that we've got chief executives of key companies overseeing each of the work streams. That our steering committee is composed of business leaders who lean in very directly to provide their support and assistance. We've now got over 180 CEOs across the depth and breadth of the economy who've signed up to the pledge, committing themselves, their companies, their sectors to addressing the challenges we've got. The second, of course, was aligning on what the key interventions were. There were a number of parties on both sides who wanted to broaden the scope, and our view was that we needed to get these three up and running before we extend the scope to other areas that are being looked at now, such as water, which we know presents a very significant crisis, other forms of infrastructure, particularly municipal infrastructure, the role and the capacity of small and medium-sized enterprises, red tape. All of those are key areas, but those of energy, transport and logistics and crime and corruption were not controversial. What was controversial was agreeing even within those areas where it was that we need to focus our time and effort, both as business and as government, and to agree on a critical path of interventions over the next 3, 6, 9, 12, 15 months so that we could monitor our progress and account for it in a transparent, consistent, but comprehensive way to the country at large. And I think that it took time, understandably, to settle down. Interestingly, under the seventh administration, as I said, the government of national unity, both sides have recommitted themselves to the partnership, pledged to actually put more resources into the program, just as in Vulindlela, we have seen Vulindlela 2 come into fruition. And I do believe, therefore, that we'll see even more traction building on the progress that we made in phase two, relative to the achievements that that we saw during phase one, Jimmy.
Martin, let's look at that phase two. What are we expecting? I mean, when we started, actually, when phase two was launched, we kind of had an idea of around 140 plus CEOs that had committed to being part of phase two. That number's gone up to 180, as you've now said. What are we now expecting for phase two? What's been tabled as the roadmap or the outline of what we hope to achieve here?
Yeah, so first of all, we need to make sure we've stabilized the progress made during phase one. It's easy to say, but difficult to achieve. Secondly, to ensure that we can deepen and broaden our commitment as a country to structural reform, to ensure that under an appropriate regulatory environment, the private sector can play an appropriate role in all of the network industries that requires legislation being passed through both houses, signed into law, of course, by the president and operationalized. In the case of energy, obviously strengthening the regulator to establish a wholesale electricity market. We've all heard about the importance of the transmission network, and in all cases, accelerating priority projects. If we look at the case of transport and logistics, we all know that Transnet is underperforming for a variety of reasons. We need to significantly increase its projected baseline of 170 million tons per annum to well in excess of 200 in the fullness of time, to expedite the final network statement and pricing schedules, again, to facilitate private sector investment and involvement, in all cases, as I said, overseen by suitable regulatory capacity. And in the case of crime and corruption, we're very clear. There's two things we need to do. One is to see us removed from the grey list, which costs us both in terms of the cost of credit, but access to capital, and to keep off that grey list, as I indicated. And secondly, to reinforce the digital evidence unit that's being put in place to support the National Prosecuting Authority, in all cases on an arm's length basis. I think if we achieve those three, we'll have made real progress, as I said, building on the impetus momentum of phase one. But water is something that we're considering equally seriously. We know that that's a very significant challenge to the economy, as indeed is the need to mobilize infrastructural support. And all of this, I think, resonates with and actually reflects the commitment of the Government of National Unity to key areas of priority. And every single one of these interventions, as we know, needs to lead ultimately to stemming the rise in unemployment in the country, and in particular, focusing on employment opportunities for the youth. So we've committed ourselves to trying to unlock some incremental 400,000 further employment opportunities for young people by the end of 2026. But that is just, of course, the beginning.
Martin, what happens after 12 months? We're going into phase two. This is real progress we're actually making here. Everybody's kind of putting their heads together to see if we can solve these problems permanently. But what do we do after the 12 months so this doesn't fall flat?
Well, I think that it's clear that if we can establish for yet another 12 months the partnership in the form that we have already discussed, where we've institutionalized the structures that yet enable them to be flexible, dynamic, and responsible to the circumstances concerned, then the partnership most certainly should continue. That's in the interests of the country. It's in the interests of the private sector. When I talk about the private sector, I'm not talking about big business. I'm talking about all parties, large and small, particularly micro enterprises and small and medium-sized enterprises. That should be the backbone and the primary driver of inclusive growth. So I think many of us believe that we need to maintain that partnership and build on it into the future. Of course, one of the issues that we do need to acknowledge is that the government's capacity needs to be strengthened on a more permanent basis. That is not the role or responsibility of the private sector. That is why we, as both corporate and individual citizens, pay our taxes. But we are all fully committed to ensuring that in the interim, we can put in place appropriate capacity until such time as government either wants to stand on its own two feet in those areas concerned, and or to continue the partnership with business, which we will be more than happy to do.
Well, that partnership is certainly bearing fruit. We hope it does continue because, as you mentioned, Martin, it is for the benefit of South Africans more than anyone else. We'll leave it at that. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights. Martin Kingston, who's chair of Rothschilds & Co. South Africa, but also the chair of the steering committee at Business for South Africa. To learn more about this impactful commitment to South Africa's future, visit business4sa.org. That's business4sa, as in the word for, .org.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we're going to be taking a look at our personal finance segment this week. We do that every Monday, obviously. This week, we're taking a look at a very interesting concept in the world of insurance, car insurance in particular. I'm joined on the line by Data and Actuarial Sciences Manager for Blink by My Way, John Vessels, to take a look at the car insurance space and some of the myths that we've been seeing there. Good evening, John. Thanks so much for taking the time. When you think about car insurance, there's a lot of consideration that goes into it, trying to find the best deal, trying to make sure everything checks out and the car is covered and all of those things. But there's also some other areas where you might be wondering and concerned about, will my insurance cover this? Will they cover that? How do I keep my premiums down and all of that? Where do we start with this, John?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And I think a really good place to start with insurance, firstly, is that when you're buying a car, new or used, I think it's really important to include insurance in that cost. What we see is that a lot of people will buy their dream car and then think about insurance only when they're on the dealership floor and get some nasty surprises. So I think a good place to start is before you buy a car, think about, is this a risky car to insure? What does my profile look like? What kind of premium can I get for this vehicle I want? So I think that's a really good place to start. Taking insurance into account from the start when you're buying a vehicle.
Something about the premiums. I remember when I was purchasing my first car, I needed it to get to work, and I got a really high insurance quote as a first-time buyer and all of those sorts of things. And something that I've always heard is your insurance premium will get more affordable as you get older. So if you're under 25, you're considered extremely high risk. And then the older you get, supposedly the more responsible you become. Is that true?
So like with many things in insurance, there's some truth to that. So I would say yes, in general, as people get older, they do become better risks. But that's definitely not the only thing that goes into your premium. But said that, that doesn't mean that a 30-year-old is always going to have a low insurance premium than a 25-year-old. Some other key things are your claims history. So if you are a bit older, but maybe you've had many claims, you will pay a high insurance premium. And by the same token, if you are 24 years old and you've been driving for, say, 6 years and haven't claimed at all, you might get a better premium. That's where your insurance history, the type of vehicle you have, and the other type of factors come into play. So it's not only your age, and that doesn't mean if you're young and you've had a very good history that you can't get a good premium.
John, what about the color of the car? I've been told if I get a car that's a certain color, it costs less to insure because to replace those parts or to respray the car or whatever it is might not be as expensive. We see car manufacturers themselves charging you if you want metallic paint or if you want a different paint job to the standard white color that would come through. Does that affect insurance at all?
Another very good question, and I think what most people have heard is that a white car is cheaper to insure because it's more visible. And again, there's a grain of truth to that, but what it really comes down to is, in the event of an accident, how much is it going to cost to repair the vehicle? And yes, metallic paint comes into that, then you need to get speciality paints in, and that can really increase the value of repairs. Another thing people don't realize is that any modifications you have, you need to disclose. So if you've got a non-standard, I wouldn't necessarily say a non-standard paint color, but an aftermarket paint color, and you don't disclose that, it might not be covered at the claim stage. So you want to add that on as a modification to your vehicle.
Things that we're adding onto the vehicle. I like that you went there, John. The tracker. If I have a tracker on a car or if I have additional things like an immobilizer, does that make it better for insurance purposes? Does that matter at all?
Yeah, another really good question, and I think there's a myth out there that if I have a tracking device, my insurance premium is always going to be cheap. And yes, to some extent, it probably will be cheaper, but I think it really depends, firstly, on what type of device you have. So there's some devices that are better than others, some that give you early warning and so on, and others that are kind of passive devices that aren't as good at detecting risk. The second thing is the type of vehicle you have. So if you have a vehicle that isn't a high theft risk in the first place, the tracking device isn't going to change your premium much. In fact, you might be paying more for the tracking device than the benefits you get on your car insurance premium. But if you have a high-risk vehicle, certain types of buggy, certain types of hatchbacks, then the tracking device will certainly save you money. But again, it's worth checking with your insurance company what kind of saving you'll get so you don't install the device and end up paying more each month than you would.
Risk, risk, risk. Everything's always about risk with insurers. Does the risk premium is the premium affected by driving certain cars? I've seen in the past that certain vehicles are considered higher risk. And when you look at some of these automotive studies and reports that come out, they'll say that this is the most high risk vehicle in terms of likelihood of being stolen and all of that. If I buy And I'm sorry for VW Polo drivers out there, but we all know the truth here. If I buy a VW Polo, is that insurance premium affected by the fact that I bought a Polo?
A very good question. And yes, the type of vehicle you have definitely is taken into account. I think one key thing to realize is that the sum insured of the vehicle, so the value of the vehicle, is a very big factor. So yes, Polos might get stolen very often, but if you think of a car that's maybe three times the price, even though it might not get stolen as often, when it does get stolen, it costs a lot of money. So I think the key thing is that there's no risk-free car, and cars are risky for different reasons. So if you have a very fast car, in particular, young men driving very fast cars tend to be more risky, but it's certainly not the only factor that comes into play. So like I was saying before, if you have a low-risk profile, you might pay less than someone else, even if you have a high-risk car.
That sounds like a bit of a stereotype there. Young men driving fast cars. But I mean, to be fair, we've got the stats that say otherwise. While we're looking at those kinds of setups in terms of just client demographic, John, the other one that I've picked up on is certain types of cars are higher risk because they're higher performance vehicles and that sort of thing. If you have something like an advanced driving course, does that reduce your premium because the assumption there is you know how to better drive the vehicle?
Another good question. And some insurers, not all, will give you the benefits for an advanced driving certificate. And yes, it's actually an interesting point because especially those ones that do the defensive driving, they really do teach you techniques to drive better. So not insurers will, but if you have done one, it's definitely worth phoning insurance company and asking them if they'll reduce the price for you.
John, what about the late bloomers? Those that got their driver's licenses late or those that still haven't gotten their driver's licenses and might be wanting to consider that. Does the age of your license count in terms of how long you've had it?
Yes, that definitely comes into play along with your insurance history. So if you get your license a little bit later and you have a brand new license, typically, your insurance premium would be higher, but after a few years of good driving, it will reduce faster than, say, a 21-year-old who's had their license for 3 years. So what we do see is that new drivers might need to take a while to build up a bit of experience, but if they are a bit older, they tend to build up that experience quicker. But yes, it is definitely worth getting your license sooner rather than later.
John, what about rewards programs? I think about things like Discovery Vitality and any other kind of rewards programs that you might have in place. Do those factor in if I go to my insurer and say, hey, I'm a member of this rewards program, can you reduce my insurance? Aside from obviously the reductions and the relationships that the particular rewards partner might have with that particular insurer.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and we probably don't have time to go into a lot of detail, but a while back there was a case that went to, I think it was a competition regulator, where other insurers wanted to take into account certain rewards programs from competitors. Very interesting one, but on that point, yes, if you are a good driver and you have evidence to show that, that is does give you good leverage to ask for a discount at your insurance company. The other thing I'll say is that the rewards program itself, whether it's from our competitor or the one at our company, can save you money. But like with all rewards programs, you must see what's suitable for you. So if you drive a bit less, maybe one will be suitable for you. If you think you're a really great driver, then maybe one that takes that into account will save you money in the long run, especially for younger people who might be assumed to be worse drivers. But hey, if you're one of the very responsible guys in their early 20s, then a rewards program could save you a lot of money.
John, you're in the actuarial department. Obviously, you guys come up with all of these risk models and everything. What's one piece of advice that you'd give to individuals looking at their car insurance and that have listened to this conversation and might want just that one thing to do to either bring down their premium or to just be assessed better from a modeling perspective? What's that piece of advice?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I would encourage people, especially if you've been with the same insurer for a while and if you haven't had any claims, to shop around. There's a very high likelihood that you'll be able to save money. The other thing I would say is that there's some things that people don't always think about that goes into the insurance premiums. So the one thing is your credit profile. So what we do find is that people who are more responsible with their money tend to be more responsible with their cars. And related to that is paying your insurance premiums on time. So that's one very easy thing that you can do to make sure that your premiums stay low. Because when you do start missing premiums, not only might it affect your insurance at your current insurer, but through credit checks and so on, people might see that at an insurance company you want to move to. So that's what I would say. Shop around, look after your credit profile, pay your insurance premium on time. And yeah, again, always consider insurance before making a purchase to make sure that that it's in a good price range for you.
There's so much to consider when you're looking at your insurance, but there are some really easy wins, really low-hanging fruit you can take advantage of, and some things you should probably consider. Thanks so much, John, for those insights. John Vessels, Data and Actuarial Sciences Manager at Blink by MyWay, on some of the car insurance myths that are out there and what you can do for yourself.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's just gone 7 o'clock. We've come to the end of the show, which means Greg Coase is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. US elections are tomorrow. We're going to be keeping an eye on these and other market developments. But until then, good night.